This is Cubicle from the Pines' debut self-titled album. It's just been re-released on Going Underground Records. You're listening to the San Joaquin Sound Podcast. I'm your host, AJ Rodriguez. This podcast is about music in Bakersfield and the surrounding San Joaquin Valley. For this episode, I traveled to Going Underground Records to interview Ron Ramirez about the Munoz Boxing Gym. This was a legendary venue on East California Avenue. Imagine going to a show where the band is playing in the middle of a boxing ring. I first met you probably in like 2005, 2006, maybe even 2007, when I took two bus transfers to go downtown to look for records. Bakersfield downtown looked different back then. People weren't really into records yet, I would say. There was like gigantic vintage. I think you were on a store next to World Records at the time.
Yes, we were there first, though.
Yeah, and I was some punk kid. I probably rollerbladed to get to the bus, and I came inside, and I said, my favorite thing to tell people was like, what type of music genre is your favorite? And I remember asking you, and you just said, the Germs.
Wow. And, true. Still, to this day. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's my first memory of, and I went to your store here and then as a kid. Yours was the last resort. I would go to Goodwill. They had 10-cent records. There was one on Chester. There was one on Rosedale Books that I like to go to and just dig through every single crate. And if I couldn't find it, I would come to you because you had everything organized and you had everything in from A to Z. One time you gave a speech on Zoom that I attended, and you talked about basically that for Bakersfield, a lot of people can sometimes get down on Bakersfield for a lot of different reasons, but one of the things that you said you believe in is to build up Bakersfield music, because if people from Bakersfield don't do it, then who will?
Bakersfield is often looked down upon, so we have to put it on a pedestal, and we have to do our best to make sure that like people know that this is as good as any place else.
And that's what I wanted to do with this podcast called San Joaquin Sound, and I wanted to talk about a lot of the different music that comes from here that a lot of people maybe don't know about. This episode is going to be about the Munoz Boxing Gym, and so I want to talk a little bit about before you had a venue, before you had a band, what was it like growing up as a kid listening to punk?
I probably started listening to punk rock early, you know, early 90s, maybe late 80s through my dad. But got serious maybe like 92-ish.
I guess I remember hearing you say that you got to go to a Suicidal Tendencies show
at the Civic Center, yeah.
Yeah, in 1993. Yeah.
Okay.
And did you like punk before then?
I did, yeah. You did? I was familiar. I used to watch 120 Minutes, Headbangers Ball.
Nice.
Every Saturday, Friday, or whatever it came on, I would stay up and watch it. So anything that was like kind of out of the ordinary would always pique my interest. And that's how I learned about a lot of underground stuff from those shows.
Your dad loved punk music already?
He was into punk. He was more so into heavy metal, but he would show me Discharge, New York Dolls, Social Distortion, and Exploited. You know, like kind of standard classics that were, I guess, weren't classics at the time, but, you know, kind of normal punk rock. That's how I learned a lot of that stuff.
Nice. And what about your mom? What type of music did you learn from her?
She did not like punk rock. She still doesn't. She's into like Earth, Wind & Fire, Al Green, Marvin Gaye. Soul music is what she's always enjoyed. Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, nice, yeah. Nice. Classics.
Yes.
Classics in their own right. So what about your grandparents? I know when we talk about the gym was Paul Munoz, your grandfather. Mm-hmm. What type of music did he or your grandmother listen to?
My grandpa was really into country music. So if you would go into the gym, before everybody got going, he would be playing KUZZ on the radio every day, and it was without fail. It would be on. Usually during the training too, it'd be KUZZ. Sometimes the boxers would change it, but it would always be country music. My granny wasn't really into any kind of music. She listened to talk radio. She had no interest in music.
You mentioned that he loved country music. It makes me think of my grandfather. And I have a KUZZ keychain on my keys, but I did not like country music. But it's because my grandpa gave it to me. And so he loved KUZZ, and he just loved it. He loved Buck Owens because he was from Bakersfield. He liked country music, especially because he was from Texas.
Okay, but do you go back and listen to country music? Do you go back and listen to Buck?
Yeah.
And it you works. Know, it works more than it ever did, right?
I like it. It's like, yeah, I don't like it as a genre, but I like Buck Owens because of one, he's from Bakersfield. How can you not like someone from Bakersfield that sang about Bakersfield? You know, as I went to see Kyle Burnham, he was the drummer at the time. I think he still is, but I would have to double check on that. For Buck Owens' son's band that plays all his songs,
yep.
And going into there was just so cool because I just was thinking about my grandparents who just loved Buck Owens, loved country music.
Buck was the man.
Yeah.
Still is. Yeah, my grandpa loved Buck Owens and KUZZ. And I didn't really appreciate it at the time. But I will say every time we get the Buck Owens Greatest Hits Volume 1 LP, it gets played throughout the whole day. And it's great.
One of my best memories of my grandfather that I still talk about with my dad sometimes is when we were in his car. And my grandfather was very proper, I don't know is the right word, but he didn't like swear words and stuff to be around me at all. So if there was ever a song on the radio that swore, he would turn it down. And so there was this one time we were in the car and there was this Toby Keith song where he says, "Boot up your ass." And that's the lyric. And my grandpa got ready to turn it down, but instead he cranked the volume right when it said ass. And my dad and me were just laughing so hard. And my grandpa was laughing. It's just one of my best memories of music and my grandfather is that moment where he just cranked it up instead of turning it down.
Yeah, that's good.
You stayed interested in punk rock. A lot of people just suddenly don't like it anymore when they get older. What kept you interested?
I think it's just a big part of my life. It was when I was a teenager, and I guess it still is. I was just drawn to it.
Did you do any other stuff than music? Did you skateboard a lot?
I did skateboard early teens up until, I don't know, early 20s. My body doesn't really feel like it needs to ride a skateboard anymore, so I opt out. Kind of hurts.
Skateboarding is always connected, and rollerblading by extension is always connected to punk rock for me. I remember the first time I really heard like a real punk song was when my friends invited me over to play Tony Hawk Pro Skater on the Nintendo 64, and just we started up the game and it would always warn you don't have the extra memory pack, you don't even have a rumble pack, you don't even have a memory card, you can't save this. And then once you get past all those warnings, then all of a sudden you just hear Dead Kennedys' Police Truck, but an instrumental version because the lyrics were too crude to go on a Nintendo cartridge. It was on the PlayStation 1, but not on the Nintendo. And I just remember that blowing my mind, hearing that song. And all the songs on that game are burned into my memory.
That's a classic soundtrack now.
So are there other people in your family that work in music?
I think the most notable one to the local area would be my cousin Timmy, Tim Gordea, who at this point would be considered a legendary promoter in Bakersfield.
Did you get to go to a lot of shows?
I did. I did. I went to a lot of shows. A lot of the times when I was really young, 13, 14, my mom would like work. She would sit at the front table and like kind of like take your ticket. My dad would be like doing backstage stuff if anybody was acting up. So they would all be there. But my mom just stayed around. My dad was just crazy, but my mom would stay around just to make sure I wasn't getting into any trouble is what her job was. So that's why she was there. She didn't give a damn about who was playing. She just wanted to watch me, make sure I wasn't getting in trouble.
So your grandfather and his brothers were boxing promoters, and now you and your cousin are music promoters.
I wouldn't consider myself a promoter because I've never made any money on it. But Timmy is a legitimate promoter, yes. And some people might have like a concept of Timmy from like the 90s because their band didn't get paid $75 to open some show, and Timmy gave all the other money to the band or the touring band or whatever. So I hear that kind of stuff, and it's annoying. Like, let it go. Like, you're talking about $80 20 years later. Don't worry about it. Who cares? What do you care? Timmy's a good guy.
Well, I've never heard any of that, but now you told me it. How could you spread this?
It's out there.
I'm just kidding.
I wasn't crying because I mentioned about Timmy.
Yeah.
Leave him alone. Timmy would book like all the, like when Offspring played here on the Smash Tour, he booked that. Or that's like cool. Face to Face would play here, he booked that. RKL, Sublime.
No I doubt. Always remember seeing his name on posters like, it always said Tim Gardea presents.
Yeah. So me and my dad used to do promotion. We would go, he would like drop us off with a box, like a bag, and then staples, and then just like massive amounts of flyers. But this is back when it was Spilt Milk production, so that's like the old school, like real deal one. But when you would see those red and white flyers on the like poles and stuff, it's because me and my dad used to go up and we'd tape them. So that's how I learned how to, okay, this is how you put up flyers on a pole for the concert. This is how you promote because of that. So that's why I learned all that kind of stuff from. You don't pay somebody, you just get out and fucking do it. It'll be all right. Who cares?
I want to talk a little about the DIY ethic. And I think because the gym isn't a space, wasn't built, you know, to host music, that I think that it would apply, that you're just using the DIY ethic. But first, could you define like the DIY ethic for people that may have never heard of it?
I don't know what it's supposed to mean to other people, but I would say to like me and our crew is just this, like, we don't wait for other people to do something for us. If we want to do something, if we want a show to happen, we're going to call the band. We're going to email the band. We're going to get a hold of them. Hey, I'd like you to play here. What do you think? Can we make it work? So I guess in a general idea, if you want something done, you just do it. Just like anything else. Just, you don't have to have money. You don't have to have a sponsorship or any kind of backing. You just make it happen. You don't have to also profit from something. You just do it because you want to do something.
Yeah. I think for me, a lot of times I do it myself for a lot of different things, a lot of creative projects and stuff, just because it's just out of necessity that it always has been. Whatever. A lot of times I'm working on stuff that other people aren't interested in. And so if I want, I mean, this podcast is a perfect example. I wanted to listen to a podcast about Bakersfield music and the history of it, and there's not one. So then I just have to make it then.
No one else is going to do it.
Exactly.
And maybe they'll do it wrong. Maybe they already did it and they did it wrong.
True.
Or it's about Jerry's Pizza or something boring like that.
Oh, man. I think there's just something powerful about creating something, whatever it is. And a lot of times we wait for something. Do I have the right equipment? Do I have the right budget? But at the root of it all, those are all just excuses. Sometimes you just have to make it with the stuff you have now.
Yeah. We never had good equipment. We never had money. We just got whatever we can get, and we made it work. We would always get a new PA. We'd blow it up and beg my friend Darren for another one or try to borrow one just to get these shows going. We didn't have anything, but we had a lot of shows. So I guess we did something right.
You did something right because people wanted to play there. You started out, like you said, people were skeptical because it's not like any other place.
No, it's unheard of.
I remember reading about and watching about like Bones of Brundage and seeing like there's all these venues I never heard of. But then they interviewed you and I was just like, it was only like a couple minutes and you said there was this boxing gym. And I just remember thinking, what? Go back. What? Tell me more.
No, I didn't want to. That's why that's all there was. I didn't want to talk to him about it.
I see.
Nate was, me and Nate were fine to an extent. He was kind of spicy at first with the gym. Like he would steal flyers and I would catch him stealing flyers and we had words. But him and Drew were good friends. So we never had any problems after that. He knew that the stuff that we wanted to do wouldn't make him any money. So he had no interest in it. So he left us alone and we didn't have any problem with him. We had a great relationship after that. I didn't want to share something with him that I didn't feel that needed to be shared.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. We were our own world.
Yeah.
And if you're in that world, you're in that world. And it was for us. And that's it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm lucky to hear this stuff then. Do you have any advice to maybe just some young punk musicians that are trying to make music right now?
No. None.
Do it yourself then.
They'll figure it out. They don't need to listen to me. I don't know anything anymore.
That's fair.
They got it all figured out. The kids are doing it better than we probably did right now.
That's true. And they have more resources. I remember trying to buy at the Wooden Nickel like a Tascam recording unit to try to record, and I didn't know how to work it at all. It didn't come with a manual. And but now in your phone you have a whole box right there to record multi-track for free.
There you go.
To understand the Munoz Gym as a music venue, you just can't understand it if we don't know about your grandfather. And he fought so many boxing fights in the 40s and 50s, and he even knocked out an Olympic champion on December 13th, 1948. He was boxing in Strelick Stadium at the time, which became Strongbow Stadium and then the Dome. So what was he like, and how did he run his gym?
He was the best. How did he run his gym? You would just come. It didn't matter if you had money or not. If you wanted to learn, if you were serious and you wanted to learn how to box, he would show you. If you just needed to get off the streets for a little bit and you wanted to hit the bags, you could come in and do it. He wouldn't kick you out, nothing. So he was there for the community for the whole time. And he took great joy in like helping people out.
How did your grandmother influence the gym at all? I know that they both ran an egg business in the same location.
Correct. The gym was originally for where the chickens were. So they built it to house the chickens. The eggs would be stored in what we called the ice box, which was in the building in between the gym and the house. It was like a brick building that was constructed to store the eggs. So she and him had the egg business. He worked after he quit boxing, he worked for Farmer John Egg Company. And then he had a falling out with them. And then my granny and him started an egg business, which did very well until they couldn't do it anymore. And then he did a lot of boxing and he worked at Milt's in Oildale.
Paul had five brothers, Sammy, Lupe, Rudy, Sal, and Joe, and they all were boxers.
Lupe wasn't a boxer. He was the manager. But every other brother was a boxer.
Oh, okay. So he was a promoter.
Yeah, he would take care of the promotion.
I read that he took over Steve Strelick's when he was promoting, that he took over eventually.
Yeah, all of them were, it was all, the whole family. They went from working in the fields to boxing.
Was he a quiet person, or was he more the type to just talk to anyone?
I wouldn't say he was quiet. He would talk to you, though, if you got him. Yeah. No, he's not quiet. He's very, I mean, that guy was a celebrity at one point, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy that I guess that's crazy is the wrong word, but it's incredible that he boxed here at Strelick Stadium as you know, a teenager, and then went on to teach so many people boxing. I mean, it could be hundreds, thousands. I don't even know how to count all how many students he had.
Had to be easily thousands.
Thousands?
Easily. He would have never stopped if his health didn't stop him.
Yeah. Did he have any life lessons that he liked to teach? Like, do you remember any like lectures or like different speeches he would like to give to the boxers?
He wasn't really like a speech giver. He would just tell you like things, like phrases, like certain aspects of things to say. It could be anything. It could be like when you're driving, watch out for the other guy. Just stuff, simple things just like that like click and you don't forget. It wasn't like, oh, you know, here's this long-winded speech about this, and this. No, it's just, hey, put your hands up when you're boxing. They're going to hit you in the face. Keep your hands up.
Nice.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more, but that's, you know, a couple of things that I
did. Did you ever box?
I tried. It wasn't for me. He wanted me to. At the time, I just wanted to skateboard. I should have listened.
Yeah.
I know a little bit.
No, you knew enough to handle yourself.
Correct. You know, I was telling Alex earlier when we were looking through your timeline that you sent, which was a great timeline. I hope to see more. He was asking me about the boxers that would come and train. He was like, well, there's always a lot of people there. And it reminded me when I was a kid, there would be guys just in like sweatsuits, like jumping rope on the sidewalk on East California. We're talking 10, 15 trainers every day training. My grandpa would be out there just boxing, teaching these guys what to do. But it was like the place to be for a long time for these guys that wanted to learn how to box. So you go there, I'd get home from school and I would go to my granny's house and these guys would just be out there just boxing all day. It was insane. It's insane to think about it. You would look at East California and you just see guys just jumping rope. It's just another time.
One of the most interesting things is I never saw anything about like Paul Munoz trades anyone or Paul Munoz sells, except for one, that he traded a guy's contract for a Cadillac and it became his name. The boxer was named Kid Cadillac from then on.
That's fucking cool.
Do you ever remember him rolling around in that Cadillac?
Sadly, I didn't get to see any of that Cadillac. He was a fancy guy at one point, though. But I think by the time I was born, he had a station wagon, which was cool, I guess. He used to drive, he had a van and he would drive down to Mexico and pick up boxers and then smuggle them back over.
Nice.
Often.
Wow.
So he had a van for that and for egg deliveries as well.
I read an article where your grandfather talked about he's always waiting for his champion. What did you think he was looking for in a champion?
He would have guys that were going to be, that were projected to be really good. He knew they were good. They were good. And then he would have other people that he thought were his friends steal them from him. So I think what he meant by that is that he was waiting for a champion that wouldn't leave him. So he would have people that were close to him that would turn on him, take the guy, and the guy would go nowhere.
So it's almost like sometimes he was like that tiny label that discovers an artist, and then the artist tries to go with a major label. And
yeah, he would have trust in people, and they would hurt him. That's all it was.
That's difficult.
It happened numerous times. But he's not going to make you sign something. He's just going to shake your hand. Yeah, we'll do it. So that's probably it. I think he gave up.
Even though he didn't find some world champion or something like that, it really does seem like he had a bunch of people that he taught to be champions in their own way.
Yeah. You know what? The people that weren't champions are the people that went in there and just trained and made a connection. And I see a lot of people, they come in and they see my grandpa's picture on the wall and they ask like, How come Mr. Munoz is right there? That's my grandpa. Oh, I used to train there. Da, da, da. Okay, that's great. I love to hear it. So even him just being in a mural that Omar painted on the wall is just like special. Like people see that and they still remember him, which is really cool.
He should be in the Hall of Fame, like in the Bakersfield Sports Hall of Fame or something. Or
do they have that? Is that a thing?
They do have it, but
well, let's get him in if they have it.
We should get him in there. It's like the Bob Elias Hall of Fame, and I don't think he's in there, but he should be.
Okay, that's your job.
I will do my best. Also, like I was, when you go to the Centennial Garden or whatever they call it now, Rabobank or Dignity Health Arena, like they have all these people. I like walking around when I go into if I ever go to a Condors game and seeing all that, all the sports people. He should be in there too.
See what you can do.
I guess we should talk about some of your bands. Your first one was Struggle with Fate, and then you had Prolapse, The Kill, Death Valley Driver, The Contaminators, and Human Mess.
So yes.
At first, you were playing shows at around town before the gym was a venue.
Correct.
And where were you playing?
We would play at Jerry's, and this is when you could just book your own shows at Jerry's. There was no Nate monopoly, so anybody could book shows. So we would book shows there. We had a lot of successful shows. We played at houses. There's a place on the east side called Big Daddy Rick's. I think we only played there once or twice. We got kicked out and no more shows from us. But that was probably about it. There wasn't a lot of places for kids to play.
I read that you got kicked out of Jerry's Pizza, and that's what really led to you making the Munoz Gym into a venue.
Yes, that is true.
You ended up making the Munoz Gym into a home for punk rock in Bakersfield. It became legendary. People talk about it in... I was reading a bunch of different zines, and people are listing it as the best show that they played on their tour. Was it always like that at the beginning?
No. It was hard to get people to come to the shows because they were scared, because it was on the east side and they didn't want to go to the east side, or they would look at it and not think much of it, which, yeah, it was a rough building, but it's punk rock, so what do you expect? It's supposed to be scary and it's supposed to be dangerous. And that is the perfect setup for a punk rock show.
Yeah, that's what you want with your first show, to have people coming back. That's good. If you were walking into the gym, could you just describe what it was like when you walked in?
Sometimes it would smell like sweaty boxers. Not like your underwear, but like men boxing and sweating a lot. That was a strong smell. Like if nobody threw out like the bucket of spit before, it would have like a really gross smell. So I would have to do that if my grandpa didn't do it. Sometimes it would smell like cat, which is disgusting. That was typically the either smell you're going to get. So if you like, you went there a lot, you knew what it smelled like. Obviously, ironically, I miss that smell a lot. It's kind of a bummer, but oh well.
It doesn't have a stage. Like, the stage became the ring, right?
Correct, yes.
So how did that change shows compared to other places?
So there's no stage. So instead of there being a barrier from a band to the crowd, now you're free to go into the ropes and walk up right to the band. And you're going to stand right to where the microphone is. You're right here to the band. I'm holding two hands close together. So you're as close as you want to be.
So no security. It basically broke down all the barriers.
We had no security there. We probably had two fights over close to 20 years. No one came there to fight.
That's surprising when you like, if you watch Bones of Brundage, you get the vibe that there was a lot of violence. Not that people that went to shows were violent, just that every once in a while there would be some huge fight. They talked about a few massive fights, and punk music has a very aggressive tone. It's very loud. So how were you able to keep such a peaceful atmosphere?
I wouldn't say it was peaceful, but I think in our little world that we knew that we weren't the enemy. So, you know, that time and place that where it's you against everyone else. Not to be cheesy, but like, it's a good record to not have fights there. We literally, couple fights, maybe three. That's it. Ever. You're not going to act up because everybody there is friends. Everybody knows each other.
So there was just a level of mutual respect among everyone.
For the majority, yeah, I would say.
And
there has to be.
And even then, I know you got the cops called on you before, and your grandfather was respected in the community and was able to say, hey, it's just a concert. You don't have to worry.
Yeah, he did. I think the second time the Locusts played, and there was probably 200 to 300 people there, and we had never had any that many people there. But you couldn't walk in. There was people outside, out front, and of course the cops are coming. It's loud. And my grandpa's in there just hanging out, and he talks to the police, and they say, okay, Mr. Munoz, and they left. He let them know that it's under control, and he had it under control. And they respected him, and they let us do this insanely illegal activity. And I think the only other time the cops came was when the band Hellshock and War Torn were playing, but it was like 1 a.m., and it was loud. It was too late. So I understand that. So we try to, like, keep it over by, you know, be respectful of the neighbors. We figured it out.
Another thing about other venues is that there's always a bar. Like, it's always a dive bar or something like that. But you had no bar. How did that change how the shows went at all? Or did it even affect anything?
I think the bar's there for the venue to make money. So the whole point of the gym is not to make money. It was to have a space for bands to play, for our band to play, and for people to be able to see these bands that there was no interest by anyone else that was booking shows to book. So if you wanted to bring the beer, that's fine. You can bring it. Just throw away your trash. Which it wasn't always the case, but whatever. There was the dynamic of having a bar and making money wasn't an option. I don't drink, so I had no interest in that.
Is there any, like, straight edge scene in Bakersfield?
Everybody that ran the gym was straight edge. Me, Adam, Steven was maybe when he was younger, but as he grew up, not so much. But mainly me and Adam, you know, me, Steven and Adam are the ones that made that thing work, through the duration of it. So 2 out of 3 of us were, yeah.
That's cool. Your grandfather ended up using the gym as a safe haven for some of the people in the neighborhood to just have a place to go and something to do, especially the youth. And so do you feel like you continued that legacy? It certainly seems so with the way that you had punk rock shows.
I think so. I didn't mean it at the time, but like, there's a lot of people that I know now that I knew when they were little kids there. Not in a weird way, but I knew they would come to shows when they were kids, and I still see them. So I think that's important. A lot of people went there, maybe they were drugged out and they needed some place to hide, or they couldn't go home or something. So that's where they went.
That's amazing. So your first show in 1998 had Prolapse and Feces and Blood. What was that like?
That show actually did really good. A lot of people came to it. Somehow it was like a decent opening. Roger and Kurt from the Pine, they played in a band that covered this other band called Link songs. So they would play all Link covers because they were really into that. Fat Chance played and the LeBex played. So it was like a big mismatch of local bands. You know, ironically, I don't think Fat Chance ever played or wanted to play again. And same with the LeBex. But everybody else played there all the time. The Pine was like a house band. Obviously, our band was a house band.
What about any other shows? Were there? What was the most packed show? Was it that Locust one you were talking about?
That was huge. excuse me. The most packed one was probably the last show when Infest played. It was like dangerous packed. We had a lot of pretty good size shows, but that was probably like the that was the finale. So
yeah. How many people do you think went, if you had to guess?
350-ish, I would say. It was wild.
It's important to know that when I've read about the gym, they've explained it as smaller than a two-car garage. Those 350 people packed in, that's a lot of people. That was...
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Extremely. So, you mentioned something earlier that would make it different, a show at the gym, right? So when in the first days of the gym, there was the ring, like a typical boxing ring. Throughout the years, the rings would get ruined and they'd be replaced, but eventually it was just done. There was no ring. It was just a square. But so what happened with that is that the kids in Bakersfield created like a side-to-side style of the mosh the bands are playing. So you would have this thing that no one's ever seen, maybe an HB Strut back in L.A., which was kind of forgotten about at the time. So you see this certain like style where the kids go from one side of the ring to the next, back to back, like in a line, like a side to side. And at the time, you would not see it. I've been to a million shows everywhere. You would not see this style anywhere unless you came to Bakersfield and played at the gym. And it wasn't like they were trying to be cool. It's just adapting to your surrounding. You would go from one side of the rope to the other side, and they would like fly off of it and go back and forth. So we had our own kind of style, and you would play here. You would see this. It was very unique.
That's awesome. Did any of the bands incorporate the ring into their shows in some way? I know I saw one where it looked like people were doing wrestling in the middle of the shows and stuff like that.
That was one of our bands that we did.
Oh, nice.
They did do wrestling, yeah. The bands, no, I think that most of them, there were some bands that didn't really like it. Maybe there wasn't like a lot of people there. But I think a lot of bands appreciated it, especially like looking back on it. Like if you were like in a underground DIY band through that era, you probably played there, especially if you're like, you know, looked upon, you know, nicely now. You most likely played there.
Were there any like shows that had like only like five people, but yet the band played it like it was a sold out arena that was just, you couldn't even tell?
Yeah. I mean, these are bands that maybe their show in LA had 20 people. So they're playing in Bakersfield to 7 people. It's like, okay, this is just the way it goes. Not everything is going to be perfect. But I think a lot of these bands, they were just excited. They're just young. You know, you're young and you're excited to be on the road and away from home and playing your songs. So no matter where you're at, it could be okay. I think it's important for people to get together and remember that like they're all in the same boat, I guess. So they don't have to, they're not everyone is so separated. So if you're going to the show, like you're there because you're probably, you know, not accepted really anywhere else. Or maybe you feel like you're not accepted or you need someplace to hide out. So those places are good for you to go and know that you're going to be okay.
So the Munoz Gym, it still existed as a training facility, right? When you were using it as a music venue?
Correct.
And, I think I read it was something like from 4 to 8, people would train, and then after that, it could be used as a music venue.
Yes. The guys would be there every day training. Sometimes they wouldn't want to leave, but we had to, you know, get the show going on, so they had to go.
Boxing is a very aggressive, violent sport, and punk rock is so aggressive and violent with moshing and... But not in a mean way. Just in a similar way, it seems like a teenager could get out whatever he's feeling by boxing or by going to a show. It's almost a similar outlet in that way. Have you ever thought about that?
No, never, not once. I see your point. I think it could go either way. Yeah, I've never thought about that. Boxing is entwined into my childhood, so it's like something I literally saw every day.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily see it as violent. I see it as like a skill.
True.
Yet it is a violent skill, but it's more of an art form. The art is to not get hit, and it's hard to do properly.
That's interesting. The part of boxing is to not get hit. I never thought about it like that. If you never get hit, you win by decision.
My grandpa did get hit a lot. He did not get hit a lot. The only reason he stopped boxing is because my granny made him.
I have it on the timeline, but he had some crazy statistic that they quoted, like 122 wins and 4 losses or something like that.
His win-to-loss ratio, I don't remember it exactly, but it was very good. I think he lost under 4 times total. He was a very good boxer.
Did he ever go to the concerts?
Yeah, like, he would always be there.
Was he always there?
Always. Nice. We live right behind, so that was our house. So we were always there. He would come out, he'd be raking, making sure, his thing was make sure there was toilet paper in the bathroom. Like, Grandpa, this bathroom is disgusting. No one needs to be going to the bathroom in here. I don't want toilet paper. And we'd have to argue every show about toilet paper. So why are you so concerned? This bathroom is disgusting. It's going to clog. Let me just turn it off. Because I know these people, they did it every time. I'd have to clean it up. It sucked. Anyways, he was always there. He would sit down and watch the show. He would hang out. He'd talk to the bands. There's a picture of my grandpa in this band from Denmark, Ice Age. It's like one of the best pictures. He's just like rapping with them inside. He would just hang out. He was always there. He loved it. He loved those people being there, being in the gym. Even like not using what it was intended to, he loved it.
We talked before about your grandfather, how he was always looking for a champion. But do you ever think that you're the champion?
Absolutely. I was his favorite person in the world. Why do you think he let me do shows at the gym, ruin his boxing gym? He helped me for everything, for the store, with the shows, just in life. Yeah, absolutely. Number one. Without a doubt, I was his favorite person in the world. You have that confidence, it means a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone believes in you. It matters.
It's more than anything. We wouldn't be sitting right here if it wasn't for him.
Yeah, I would agree. So.
That's crazy, by the way. I've never thought of that. I've never thought of it that way. I wouldn't give myself that much credit, but that's crazy to hear that.
Yeah, I thought of that. I hoped it wasn't too rude of a question or something.
I don't think it was. It's just weird when you're on the receiving end, I think. It's just not that it's just kind of awkward.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense. I mean, I know how close we were, so.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm only looking outside and saying what, you know, I just noticed so much when I was researching about how much he was waiting for a champion. But.
Well, okay, so he had 3 daughters. I was the first boy. So I was the one. He loved every one of his daughters, obviously. But, like, you know, I guess it's different. It was different for him. He wanted a boy, and I was the one. And that was it. And we were very close.
That's good.
Yeah.
I would like to end every show by talking about a current band or some sort of current of any art that you want people to know about.
Okay, let's do it.
What's a current band from Bakersfield that people need to hear?
People should listen to Gold. That's probably my favorite local punk band, but I'm biased because Nate works here and my son sings. So, but that's okay. I'm also putting out their record on Friday, May 9th.
Nice. Any other bands that you think people should hear? Yeah, from here, or even that you produce or something.
From here, there's a lot of good bands right now. If you're into punk or hardcore, 415 has all the shows. So that's going to be like where you're going to go to see the modern day version of what we did at the gym. That's essentially the carryover. So what we did at the gym, like setting up this entire infrastructure of shows and a network of people that want to play here, and a scene essentially from almost nothing, is continued in 415. That's what those kids do now. They don't do it to make money. They do it so bands have a place to play and kids can come have some place to be. So any show that happens at 415, pay attention to that. If you're into like underground music, hardcore, punk, it doesn't really stray too much from that. But if you didn't get to see the gym and you're like, oh man, I saw that Jerome's Dream video on YouTube. Okay, that's great, but go to 415 now, because that's right now, and you can be a part of anything you want to be a part of. So every show, pay attention to that.
And 415 is the venue?
Correct.
Nice.
We won't give the address on here, but they can figure it out. Look on our Instagram, or come to the store and get a flyer. But yeah, local bands, Pump Fake, Gold, God, that's G-A-H-D, Rough House, let's think, Epilepsy, Sack Tap. I'm leaving a lot of people out. Okay, that's all I can remember. But just go look on 415's Instagram or come by the store.
You just have to say et cetera at the end, and then if someone tells you that you left them out, just say, no, nah, that's what I covered that on et cetera.
Sorry about that. It's not because I'm not, just to put it out there, it's not because I don't want to say your band's name. I can't think of it.
It is hard. I feel like there's so many things I know, but if people ask me on the spot, then for some reason I forget it.
And then non-local bands, Gun, Pseudo Youth, The Smog, those are all bands that we have records coming out from on our label, Going Underground Records. So those are all available either now or they will be by the time this comes out. So listen to them or stream them online. Buy the records from me.
This song is Annihilation off Gun's new album.
Let's talk about this record I'm releasing from a local band called The Pine.
Okay, so they were active. They were playing shows at the gym, right?
Have you ever heard them?
I have listened to some of their sets on YouTube at the Munoz.
Okay,
gym.
The last show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so those were friends of mine, obviously, from back then. But our label, Going Underground, is reissuing their records, so... It's a big deal to us because that band is probably one of the most important local bands ever. Hands down. Top five, best Bakersfield band, best emo band, anything. And I don't just say that because I'm biased, but I love their catalog. We have the first LP coming out again. It's actually sitting right behind you. But we're very excited to have that out again. It means a lot to us, to me and Adam, to... have this record come out on Going Underground. It's a massive deal. So when we speak about the gym, like The Pine was a huge part of the gym. Roger booked the second show there, which was Flu 13. So it's Flu 13, and then The Pine played, and that's the first era of The Pine with Roger on drums, Josh and Kurt on bass and guitar, which was massively different from what they ended up being. But just hindsight, so we go all the way back. So like the first show is like all locals. The second show is Flu 13 and The Pine, and I think the third show was God Stomper and probably Prolapse and something like that. And I mean, there's not really anybody at those shows, but just, you know, we're trying really hard to do the shows is what I'm saying. But anyways, back to The Pine, we're excited to have this record come out. It's a massive Bakersfield release,
and those reissues are important. I didn't know about the band Burning Image until you reissued one of their
single, yeah.
Single, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's crazy. A lot of people that I thought would have known that didn't know that record. Like people that are in the punk record collecting circuit, like didn't know it, which is crazy to me because that's, I don't know, maybe because we're from here, that's like a big record. That's a huge record.
Yeah, it was crazy to see in the 80s. It's not like it was like when this type of music, if you... were dressing like they were and walking down the street, people would have really been judgmental.
They were 1,000% all in. Amazing. Did you see the pictures like I would post to those guys?
I didn't see the pictures you posted, but I looked all in the labels. I even showed this guy, this drummer named Kyle Burnham, and he's like, oh yeah, I already knew about this because Joe Sparks, he went to the same high school as I did in Taft. And I was like, holy shit, small world.
Yeah. Those guys are cool. I love Mo. That's a great... Burning Image is a great record.
Yeah, and there's just so much music from Bakersfield. and even just the surrounding areas that people have no clue. I was a nerd in high school that would dig through crates of records, and I didn't know about all this stuff from right here. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's very obscure. That's why I reissued the Terrorist 45 too, which is another Bakersfield record from I think 82. I forget offhand, but it's a punk record.
Nice.
Really good. Very obscure though. It's like it doesn't exist. Very rare.
I notice you have so many music posters in Going Underground of concerts from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what drives you to collect all of this stuff?
I think it's important to showcase it. It's important to show people that there's always been music here and there's always been stuff to do. People often look outside of Bakersfield for importance, or maybe not importance, but maybe like guidance in what's cool. But when you see like the bands that played here and the shows maybe someone had missed because they weren't paying attention, maybe it makes you like rethink where you're from and how it's not that bad. So like if there's a Fugazi poster on the wall, like, oh wow, Fugazi played here. Yeah, they played here twice. Ramones played here. They played one of their last shows here. Who else? I don't know. Sublime. Okay, whatever. But that's a legendary. That's a legendary show. So I like to, I don't collect stuff just because I'm like, want to have everything. I just collect it because it's important. No one else besides my friend Chris Goodsell, who gave me a lot of things related to Bakersfield and a lot of knowledge, has ever really cared. So like, it's hard to like even piece this stuff together. Like I got a bunch of great flyers from this guy, Mike, a bunch of local early 80s flyers. And the coolest thing that I got from him was a list of all the shows he went to. And so he wrote down every show. So now I get to see, okay, this guy, this is the order of the shows. And that's important to people like me because we want to know what was what and when it happened. So we can save that knowledge. Where's it going to go? If I don't know it, where's it going to go? Down the drain.
Exactly. If there's no one else archiving that part of Bakersfield history, and if you don't do it, it goes away. I mean, all these flyers are on paper. So it's important.
Yeah, I save that stuff. So me and Matt, who are doing this archive project, are working on making it where it's like you could just go on the computer and look at anything you want to see. So if you want to hear a demo from Number One, you want to hear the Number One 7-inch and you don't have a record player, you go on this archive site that Matt has created and you could just listen to it. If you want to relive, you know, the 90s, it's all set for you. So it's like a flyer digital archive. So I have a lot of stuff. So he talked me into actually letting it be seen in more places than just here. So we're working on that. So everybody can enjoy this stuff.
It's amazing. It's just so important to archive all of this stuff before it's too late. Thank you for listening to the San Joaquin Sound Podcast. If you want information on upcoming episodes, follow San Joaquin Sound on Instagram. Catch you next time.